the week of January 9th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 87, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
I guess now that we don't have Karen, you just go with the in New York instead of...
It's January and it's too cold, so I couldn't be anywhere else. But, you know, we're not done with that, but for the moment.
Well, we certainly aren't done with entertainment news. We have a ton of it to discuss on today's show. We'll be speaking with film critic Stephen Farber of The Daily Beast and Hollywood Reporter about some of the worst movie moms in history and why they keep winning awards for the actresses that played them. During Inside Baseball, we'll be joined by Ben Fritz of the Los Angeles Times, who will explain how Hollywood studios are seeking to lift barriers to online sales of films and TV shows, and also begin putting award screeners online for members of the Screen Actors Guild. We'll also go over some news coming out of the Consumer Electronics Show, which was held in Las Vegas last week, and we'll tell you why a U.S. appeals court says you have the right to sell your used CDs. Of course, as always, we will cover all the big showbiz news stories during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office for the first time is True Grit, the Coen brothers' Western. After three weekends, it finally passed Little Fockers. It grossed $15 million this weekend. It's at $110 million total. It's by far their biggest hit of all time, and it's still got a long way to go.
Well, the Coen brothers' biggest hit of all time.
Yeah, it's their biggest hit of all time. It's practically Jeff Bridges' biggest hit of all time, too, but there you go. At number two is Little Fockers, which grossed $13.7 million. It's at $123 million total, which is way down from what Meet the Fockers made a few years ago. At number three is Season of the Witch, a Nicolas Cage film that somehow grossed $10.7 million, even though it looks god-awful. At number four is Tron Legacy, the other Jeff Bridges film this week. It's at $9.8 million and $147 million total and $143 million overseas. So that's at almost $300 million and counting. At number five is Black Swan, which grossed another $8.3 million and $61 million total. At number six is the Gwyneth Paltrow film Country Strong, which I saw this weekend. It grossed $7.3 million. At number seven is The Fighter, another $7 million. That's at $57 million total for the Mark Wahlberg film. And number eight is The King's Speech, another Oscar hopeful. That grossed $6.8 million. It's at $33 million total. Number nine is Yogi Bear, and number 10 is Tangled. Yogi Bear is at $75 million total, and Tangled is at $175 million total. And, you know, I'd been thinking about this all week, and Roger Ebert, I think, tweeted briefly about it. But we had a guest on a few weeks ago talking about adult films and how there's no space for mid-range films. This week is dominated by Oscar hopefuls and movies that are just doing tremendously good box office based on how much they cost. True Grit, Black Swan, The Fighter, The King's Speech, even probably Country Strong will make money. But those four movies are really making a ton of money. They're not just sort of modest art house hits. They're making real money, and they cost very little to make.
And I would just like to underscore, when you say adult films, you're not talking about pornos.
No, I'm talking about something other than Tron Legacy and, you know, Yogi Bear. I'm talking about films made for adults. It's that sort of weird middle range film that had sort of disappeared off the radar of Hollywood for a while. Movies made about, you know, serious subjects geared towards adults and not 14-year-old boys. And all these movies are commercially, financially successful already. The Fighter, Black Swan, The King's Speech, True Grit, those were all, you know, rolls of the dice, despite their modest budgets, and they're doing great. So this is just a really good week for smart, intelligent films.
Well, now, do you think we'll see a rash of adult films or dramas, as some people refer to them, or thinking man's movies and westerns?
Well, you know, I mean, Black Swan cost $13 million to make. Country Strong cost $15 million. The Fighter cost $25 million. The King's Speech cost $15 million. True Grit cost $38 million. That is well below the average typical Hollywood, you know, romantic comedy. You just can't make a movie for less than $50, $60, $70 million these days. But these movies were made by big stars who were willing to forego their upfront fee to get a movie that they felt passionate about made. So, you can make intelligent, good films and make money doing it. And I certainly hope it encourages a wave of people realizing there's an audience out there for good cinema. It doesn't have to just be in December when the Oscar hopefuls run around.
Well, I think one of the things I keep hearing from people I speak with throughout the industry is what Hollywood has learned over the past 12 to 18 months is A star does not matter.
And no, that's they're wrong then. They're idiots.
Well,
because the Fighter stars Mark Wahlberg, the King's Speech stars Colin Firth, not a huge box office draw, but certainly a well-known name. True Grit has Jeff Bridges. Black Swan has Natalie Portman and a rising star, Mila Kunis. These movies got made because of the stars who were willing to forego their big fee to make them happen. People went to see them because they're good movies, but also because of the stars who are in them. That's how you get people in seats.
Well, maybe I should rephrase that then. A $20 million star like a Tom Cruise or a Tom Hanks or a Jim Carrey doesn't matter. You don't need to have somebody who is such a huge international box office draw. You could have a Natalie Portman, or you could have a Jeff Bridges or a Colin Firth.
But they're not making big, massive international blockbusters. If they were making movies like Tron Legacy, I'm sure Jeff Bridges got good money to star in Tron Legacy, a lot more than he did for True Grit, because that was a movie designed to be a big international blockbuster. Hollywood always wants to pretend stars don't matter. They always have, and they always will. There are people who will bring in people to the seats no matter what. Tom Cruise is a big star. Night and Day was on Quentin Tarantino's Best of the Year list.
Which we'll be talking about later.
Right, but it wasn't on most people's list. And but he brought in seats overseas. He brought in people. And so that movie you make, you always hope for a big payday. But when you have stars in it, you know you're not going to lose your shirt. And that's what stars are for. And they're always going to matter. It's wishful thinking on the part of Hollywood.
Well, that's kind of proving true with two films that did not do well here in the United States this past holiday season, but they did do well and are doing well overseas. Do you know which two films I'm talking about?
Especially in Mother Russia. Yes, you're talking about The Tourist and Gulliver's Travels. They're just starting to spread out overseas, so we're a long way from knowing what their ultimate fate is. But The Tourist stars Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie. Gulliver's Travels stars Jack Black. And they've both done torrid business in Russia, of all places. Russia's a place where people were worried about black market DVDs and getting your money out of the country. It's a country like China where it's very hard to get your money out of the country. But Gulliver's Travels had a huge opening in Russia. The Tourist is doing huge business there, bigger than anywhere else. And that's part of the story, so that Gulliver's Travels has made $81 million internationally so far. And The Tourist is already at $100 million overseas. So those movies, because of the stars involved, will not lose their shirt when all is said and done.
In Russia, Gulliver's Travels opened to $9.5 million, which was bigger than its $6.3 million U.S. box office opening.
That's unbelievable, really.
And it's earned $81 million to date so far. The Tourist has earned $100.5 million overseas. Those grosses are beating out their U.S. grosses.
Well, the international grosses should beat out the U.S. gross because there are 300 million people in the U.S. and 6 billion people in the rest of the world. So the international box office should easily double the U.S. for big, high-profile movies. It doesn't always do that because we're sort of developing multiplexes in Africa and Asia and getting more money out of China and India. So there's a huge level of growth that's out there, but international should easily outpace the U.S. when it's a movie that can play worldwide, like Gulliver's Travels and The Tourist are designed to do.
Yes, well, it used to be that international box office accounted for about 40%, 30 to 40% of a film's gross. But over the past 10 to 15 years now, it's about 60-40, 60% international, 40% domestic.
And it should grow even more. It should be 80% of the box office for the type of films that travel worldwide, you know, big summer and holiday blockbusters. And that's certainly going to be the case for The Hobbit, which is going to make a lot of money out of its two parts and should make even more overseas than it does in the U.S.
Now, I know you're trying to move us along. One thing I will say about this story about The Tourist and Gulliver's Travels is that the Russian motion picture exhibition market is somewhat underdeveloped. So there aren't a lot of huge multiplexes. It's not like the U.S. where there's a multiplex on every corner. And as you mentioned, piracy is a huge issue both there and in Romania. So I'd be interested to know how these films do, both The Tourist and Gulliver's Travels, as they hold over into future weeks. Do they drop off sharply? And of course, you can't blame just piracy on a drop-off. It could be word of mouth. But I'm wondering whether those camcorder versions will start making their way out into the public now that they've screened openly over the past weekend.
Aren't camcorder versions sort of, you know, it's the days of people sitting in the audience with a camera seem long past. The DVD black market ones I see nowadays look really, they look like they've been lifted from a DVD.
95% of all of the films that you can find online, the pirated films online, are camcorder versions.
Wow. Well, there you go. Learn something new every day.
So now you should probably get your camcorder ready for, I guess it's going to be in 3 years. You can go and sit in the balcony for The Hobbit.
Yeah, The Hobbit is coming, of course. It's being made. They're probably starting to shoot right any day now. They've been in pre-production for a while. But a little bit of weird news, broken on Deadline.com, was that Elijah Wood is going to have an appearance in the film. Apparently, he's going to be used in some sort of bookend structure so that he'll appear at the beginning of the first film, I guess, and at the end of the second. Maybe he'll ask Bilbo, tell me a story, Bilbo, and Bilbo will start to tell him about his adventures in The Hobbit. I'm not quite sure why they feel the need to have him, frankly. I don't know why they need this bookend structure. I don't know why he's going to be in the movie. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't know. Maybe Warner Brothers is spending quite a little bit of change here. They want to make sure that there's some tie-in to a very successful franchise called Lord of the Rings.
But that's asinine that the tie-in is Peter Jackson and the stories. They don't need Elijah Wood in for 3 minutes in order to do that. I don't get it. They've also mentioned that the budget for the film is about $500 million, which is about $200 million than the Lord of the Rings cost to make. That was estimated at about $300 million, and that was three films. This is just two movies, and it's costing $500 million. I don't know why it would cost $500 million. It's two movies, not three. They're shooting them all at once. I guess maybe paydays for people like Ian McKellen. Everybody knows these movies are huge properties now. It's not the issue of The Lord of the Rings where they were rolling the dice. These movies are going to gross $1.5 to $2 billion at the box office total. So everybody knows there's big money involved, and I guess maybe they're getting their money up front.
Well, the news here is that MGM and Warner Brothers have reached a deal to give Warner Brothers worldwide theatrical distribution rights to the film, or films, I should say.
Would MGM even be capable of distributing it worldwide? I mean, they seem such a shell of a company.
And that's exactly why everybody was kind of waiting for this to happen, because everyone knew that MGM wasn't going to pony up their half of the $250 million or even any portion of the $500 million it's going to cost to make these films. So instead, I guess MGM owns the rights to The Hobbit.
But they have part of the rights. Yeah, it's a very complicated.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've never really fully understood who owns what and how MGM plays into this at all. I just know that they do. And MGM, I guess, had to sign off on Warner Brothers not only paying for the entire production, but releasing everything theatrically. Now, MGM will keep foreign television rights, so they're not totally giving up everything.
Well, as far as distribution, they still have a piece of the pie when it comes to the whole Megilla.
I'm not even sure what a Megilla is, but I'm sure they probably have a piece of the Megilla.
Anyway, we're certainly looking forward to the movies. And is it Christmas of 2013 when the first one comes out?
Yes, you'll have 2 years to figure out which theater is the best theater to put your camcorder in.
Stop encouraging piracy.
I'm not encouraging piracy. I just know you're a big fan of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And I thought you might want a souvenir to take home.
Sure I would. And in fact, The Hobbit is due December of 2012.
Oh.
So it's 2 years away.
I mean, that's around the corner.
It certainly is.
I mean, when you have all of those effect shots, that's a tight production schedule.
And they'll probably be shooting for 6, 7, 8 months.
Well, I know they begin in February.
Of course, as we know, The Lord of the Rings swept the Oscars when the final version, The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, came out. It won as many Oscars as any film ever has in history. So it'll be exciting to see what happens with The Hobbit. Will they feel like this series has already been rewarded? Or will they say, here we go again, this deserves attention as well? You know, it's always tricky how award season will pan out for movies and performances. And that's one thing. The movie got almost no acting awards. It got every other award imaginable, but the actors were not really acknowledged. But, you know, fantasy films are not the way to get acknowledged. A good way to get acknowledged is to play a nice juicy role like a maniacal evil mother. That always gets Oscar voters salivating.
Well, funny you should mention that, Michael, because joining us now is Stephen Farber, a film critic with The Hollywood Reporter, and he also writes for The Daily Beast, and he wrote a post on that very subject. Stephen also runs an ongoing film series here in Los Angeles, which we should probably talk to him about. Stephen, thank you for joining us. You're going to tell us about Hollywood's bad mother obsession, which is kind of a good way to predict some of these Oscars.
Yes, that's been sort of a favorite of Hollywood in the past. Actresses playing bad mothers have often won Oscars, including last year, Monique in Precious. She won every award, and she was a shoo-in to win the Oscar, which she did, and she played, in some ways, the worst mother in movie history.
She was a hateful woman, and of course, this year we have a number of women competing for potential Oscar nominations. We have Melissa Leo in The Fighter, Jackie Weaver in Animal Kingdom, and Barbara Hershey in Black Swan. They all look like good potential nominees for Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah, I wouldn't know who to vote for there. I mean, Melissa Leo was great in The Fighter. Jackie Weaver was absolutely phenomenal in Animal Kingdom.
Well, those two, I think, are kind of the top contenders more than Hershey. I mean, you never know, because both Weaver and Leo have won already awards from different critics groups all around the country, so they seem like shoe-ins to be nominated, and it's a good chance that one of them will win. Melissa Leo is my personal favorite. I mean, she is a well-liked actress who's been around for a long time and is just finally getting some recognition. And she plays a character in The Fighter who is very vivid and memorable. She's not an evil mother exactly, but very domineering and overbearing and trying to control both of her sons' careers, and kind of she is bad news for her sons, and she really wants to run everything and doesn't want to give them any freedom in making choices. And Jackie Weaver in Animal Kingdom is really more evil, because she is sort of the mastermind of a criminal family, and at the end of the film even kind of wants to sanction the killing of one of her sons, who she feels is going to perhaps turn in the other members of the family.
When, as you say in your piece on the Daily Beast, Hollywood used to be in love with good mothers, wholesome, saintly mothers, going back to The Good Earth and The Grapes of Wrath and Mrs. Miniver.
Things started to change. Really, I think it was kind of the Freudian psychoanalytic influence on movie makers, which was huge, starting in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, which kind of looked at family dynamics as being the source of people's problems, and particularly in like the Freudian gospel, mothers were very influential in kind of twisting and perverting their children's lives. So that became something that influenced a lot of movie makers. And, you know, villains are always good characters to play anyway. And they're juicy and people can have fun with them, a little more than kind of playing like a noble character. For an actor, playing a villain or playing a darker character is often more intriguing for them, and they can bring a lot of energy to it. A lot of actors have said they kind of always have fun playing that kind of role.
Well, Joan Crawford had fun playing Mildred Pierce in 1945, and you kind of say that's kind of when this bad mother trend, if you will, it's not really a trend, you know, how many decades has it been? That's really when it turned from good mothers to bad mothers being noticed in movies.
Right. I mean, that was sort of a transitional thing, because some people would argue and say, well, she was really a good mother because she really loved her children and had their interests at heart, but she went too far. I think she was so concerned with giving them everything that she wanted that she turned her older daughter into a very selfish, pampered, ultimately a murderess character, because she had been indulged all her life by this mother who wanted to give up everything herself so that her children could have the advantages that she didn't have when she was growing up. So it's an example of a mother who loves her children, but the love turns kind of deadly as time goes on and has a bad influence rather than a good influence on her children.
And your favorite movie monster mom of all time in the movies is Angela Lansbury in The Manchurian Candidate, where she is the mother of a man being programmed to assassinate the president.
Well, I just thought Angela Lansbury's performance was matchless. I mean, there really are very few performances that can equal that. She is so sinister in the way that she... Now, she controls her husband, first of all. I mean, because this was in the 50s when there were very few women in positions of power. So her husband is actually the senator who's being groomed to take over the country. But she's pulling all the strings, I mean, because he's kind of kind of a glorified moron, but she's the one who, behind the scenes, is really making all of the plans, and she is partly responsible for turning her son into this brainwashed assassin, and she eventually wants to take over the entire country. So she has great ambitions for power, and she is completely diabolical in the way she goes about her plans. And yet Angela Lansbury is so mesmerizing, so charismatic, that you're fascinated by her every moment she's on screen. She's not on screen that much in the movie, but she kind of dominates the movie because her performance is absolutely so insinuating and compelling that she's the epitome of evil, but yet at the same time, somebody that you can't take your eyes off.
And yet, who was she defeated by but the blind Helen Keller?
Yes, that was...
At the Oscars. At the Oscars.
Yes, that was... I know that was kind of a surprise in some quarters, but I guess that was more of a feel-good movie.
Well, you know, a lot of people, a lot of Academy Award pundits and historians will say, well, you know, if you play somebody with a mental or physical deficiency, then you have a good chance of being nominated and or winning. So now you're saying if you play a mother who is completely psychotic, you have a good chance of being nominated, if the movie's any good.
Yes. I think that's very true. And yes, you always have to compete against the emotionally or physically handicapped, who are often favorites of Oscar voters as well. So sometimes, yes, there's like a competition between the handicapped victim and the evil mother.
And of course, sometimes good can prevail. Because last year Sandra Bullock won for being a really nice mom in The Blind Side, but that's more the exception that proves the rule as far as you're concerned, right?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it still happens. There have been other examples of that, too, of good mothers who have won, but I think that was sort of a feel-good movie that people embrace. But and maybe for leading actors, they're more likely to go with a heroic character, but a supporting actress is where you get a lot of these villainous mothers, like Monique last year.
Well, now, Stephen, besides being the film critic over at The Hollywood Reporter and writing reviews and articles on film for the likes of the New York and Los Angeles Times and Movie Line and Esquire, among many others, you also have a running series that takes place, I guess it's at the Landmark here in Los Angeles, called Real Talk, and that begins next Monday on the 10th. It starts up again for the year.
Yes, and I do this throughout the year at different theaters, actually, and the idea of the series is basically to screen new movies, usually before they come out in theaters, and then discuss them with the filmmaker, somebody involved with the movie, the director, the writer, the producer, actors. And the next week's series is exclusively devoted to foreign films, which I do one time a year, usually at this time of year in like January and February, because a lot of the foreign films that are being submitted for Oscars are available to be shown at that time. So this series, a lot of people signed up like the first day that it was offered. So there's still a few seats available, but we're pretty full, and we're starting out on Monday with an Israeli documentary called Precious Life, which is a wonderful film that's been shown at some festivals about a Palestinian child who has an immune deficiency and is taken to be treated at an Israeli hospital by an Israeli doctor. So it's a commentary on the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but put in very human terms.
Well, and if you want to find out about any of the Real Talk series, any of the screenings, which tend to be on Monday nights, I noticed, at around 7 p.m.
Monday night generally throughout the year.
Here in Los Angeles, you can go to Stephen's website, and it's Stephen with a P-H, so S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Farber, F-A-R-B-E-R.com, and there's links to all of the all of his writing and also all of the Real Talk series. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. Yeah, it's good to talk to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, it was good of him to take the time to talk with us. I mentioned briefly The Good Earth, which he talked about in his piece. That's a 1937 film with Louis Rainier, and it's set in China, and I have a noble peasant woman. And I saw that movie with my mom when I was a kid. She used to take me to the Revival House every week in South Florida. And I watched that movie, and no good deed goes unpunished, because in the film, they refer to the elderly people, of course, as old man and old woman, which is a sign of respect in China. So for months afterwards, I would call my mom old woman, and she didn't think that was very funny. She's not stopped saying that. I go, hello, old woman. She's like, you really can't do that. She was probably about 40 at the time, by the way.
Well, now, you're about 40 years old, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm a little bit older. I'm 44.
44. Well, then I guess, can I call you old man?
Sure you can.
Okay, well, old man, if I were to start playing some music, would you tell me to turn it down?
No, I'd tell you to turn it up.
And I assume that's because you're a big music fan.
Exactly.
And so are you buying your music on CD or are you downloading digital tracks?
Well, frankly, because the digital tracks are so much cheaper now, you can get albums on Amazon for $4 or $5. When that's an option, I'm buying digital only. I'd prefer to buy the CD, but... You know, I'm not going to pay $12 for just for the pleasure of a CD when I can get the album for $4. I can get three albums for the price of one. So I am finding more and more I'm buying digital versions of albums.
Well, you're not the only one. Of course, the end of the year, we get a whole bunch of different figures coming in. And it turns out that U.S. album sales fell 12.8% over the last 52 weeks in 2010. Digital tracks, however, eked out a slight 1% gain, which everyone is referring to as flat. Now, that 12% drop is equal to about 326.2 million albums, which is down from 373.9 million albums from 2009.
And if you put it all together, music overall, whether you're buying digital or CD, or albums or singles, whatever's happening, music sales have dropped in the past year. Isn't that right, overall?
I believe so, yes. I mean, that's the one thing, you know, there's that saying that statistics, lies, and statistics or something to that effect. Or no, it's lies, damn lies, and statistics, I think is the saying. But you really can make numbers say just about anything. And there were a number of stories this past week about music sales and how they fell and what it all meant. And they throw so many numbers at you in so many different ways and so many different viewpoints that it's kind of hard to keep track as to what they're trying to get across.
Right. Well, we linked to articles by Billboard and the LA Times in our show notes. But one thing is clear. You can tell just by looking at the best-selling albums of the year. Last year, the best-selling album was from Eminem. It was called Recovery, and it sold 3.4 million copies. And number two was Lady Antebellum, which sold 3.1 million copies of Need You Now. And at number three was Taylor Swift, who sold 2.9 million copies of Speak Now. Taylor is also the best-selling artist overall last year. If you count her earlier albums and everything all put up together, she sold more than 4 million copies, 4.3 million copies, I think, just edging out Eminem. But if you look at those numbers, that is way down from the glory days of the 80s and early 90s when you would sell 8, 9, 10 million copies of an album all throughout the top 10. So album sales are clearly way down. When the best-selling album can only go triple platinum, this is a whole new world that we're in.
Only triple platinum. Ugh,
That's way low, buddy. That's really low. But yeah, you know, like you say, I'm buying fewer albums physically. I'm getting more digital copies. And the same is true for my promo copies. I get a lot of albums sent to me for free, and I almost never get sent physical copies anymore. They almost always have me download them, which helps eliminate one problem that the record labels have, and that's of people reselling those free copies that they're sent to used record stores.
Yes, and an appeals court last week I guess it was either Los Angeles or the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has now ruled.
Yeah, that's Los Angeles.
They've ruled in three landmark cases that relate to copyrighted items like software and CDs and whether you're allowed to resell them. And it was decided last week that music reseller Troy Augusto, who was in a copyright duel with Universal Music Group, now, Augusto makes his living by buying and reselling music, including all of those promo CDs that are sent out to music critics such as yourself, Michael. You know, he was, I guess, reselling them himself and going to places like Amoeba Music to resell them. They're stamped with these words on them for promotional use only, but he was reselling them and, you know, they play just like regular CDs, so why not? Now, Universal sued Augusto and his company back in 2007, arguing that anyone distributing those CDs without its permission was violating copyright. A U.S. District Court in Los Angeles decided in 2008 that just because Universal said it retained ownership of the compact discs, that it doesn't actually mean they do. And so it's because Universal Music Group was handing out those promo CDs as essentially a gift, they never required the return of the CDs or imposed any restrictions or conditions on distribution. So now the court has said, no, that, you know, people are free to sell their used CDs.
And that would include, if this stands up, and it probably will get appealed to an even higher court.
Actually, no, it's pretty much binding now, because that's an appellate court.
Well, it could go to the Supreme Court, couldn't it?
Yes, if you really wanted to take it that far.
Well, it's a multi-million dollar issue, because you've got tons of books out there and DVDs and CDs that they still hand out and that they don't want people to resell. And they certainly try and make clear that you can't resell them. But since they never ask for the copies back, and, you know, they can claim they have the right to tell you what to do with it, but they don't. So, you know, all those freelancers who get free copies of CDs and DVDs, they're free to go resell them now. And if you go to any used CD store or used bookstore like The Strand on Broadway and 12th Street in Manhattan, you'll find tons of promo copies of books and CDs and DVDs because people get inundated with them and they resell them once they're done with them.
That's right. Now, speaking of which, you said you download more music because it's cheaper. Are you downloading the entire album?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't buy singles.
You don't buy singles. Well, it turns out that, you know, 1.17 billion singles, digital singles, were sold last year, which is barely up from 1.16 billion in 2009. But it's digital albums that are faring better, posting a 13% growth rate to 86.3 million from 76.4 million in 2009. That accounts for nearly 26.5% of all U.S. album sales last year.
Right, yeah, digital will only continue to grow, obviously.
But why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think it is that all of a sudden digital tracks are declining and digital album sales are increasing?
Because places like Amazon are selling them for $3, $4, or $5, and there are no record stores where you can go buy an album anymore. So even if I want to buy a CD, my only choices are to buy it online and have to wait for it to be delivered and pay for shipping and handling, or get it for less money, quicker, immediately, digitally. So, you know, they're pushing me to buy it digitally. You know, I'm gonna purchase it, pay for shipping, and wait a week, or am I gonna start listening to it right away?
Well, right, and the Los Angeles Times pointed out that the decline in the growth rate of digital song sales occurred as record labels pushed outlets like iTunes to raise the price of their top selling songs 30% to $1.29, and it used to be 99 cents. On the company's iTunes store, and that accounts for a majority of digital music sales.
Yeah, and some people say, well, see, now that means because singles cost more, that you're more likely to buy the album. Well, yes and no. I mean, if you just want a song, $1.29 is cheaper. If you think you want the album, yes, it's cheaper than buying each song individually, but, you know, most people don't do that. Most people only want one or two singles off an album, or they want the album as a whole.
And do you go to iTunes or Amazon, or do you have a third place that you might go to?
iTunes and Amazon. Almost always Amazon. I don't like iTunes restrictions as much. So Amazon has cheaper digital albums as well. They have a lot more consistently $4 or $5 albums. So that's where I go a lot.
Well, they are a distant second to iTunes. iTunes has 60% of the market for digital downloads.
Yeah,
music,
but
I
iTunes used to have 95% of the market. So 60% isn't so great anymore. They may be a distant second, but they're a lot bigger than they used to be.
So let me ask you this. How are you going to sell your used MP3s?
Can't resell them. That's why digital books, digital things, you can't loan them, you can't sell them. You know, even if you used to have a legal right to, but you can't resell a digital book. You can't loan it to a friend easily.
So in the end, this whole move to digital might actually help the industry.
Making content available in whatever way the consumer wants helps the industry. You know, the idea that it's a backdoor way of keeping people from handing an album to their friends or loaning a book to someone, that's stupid if that's where they're doing it, and it's not. It's just that's how consumers want it. That's how they should make it available, as flexible and as many platforms as possible.
Well, they do want to release it on as many platforms as possible, and one of those platforms now might be television. I have a TiVo, and I can listen to Pandora, or I can stream music from my computer onto the television. Not that I do, because let's face it, why would I want to do that? Most stereos sound better than the TV speakers. But now music is available on television.
What kind of a TV do you have?
I have a Panasonic. It's a HD 1020p, but I bought it in 2002, so it was before the big move to flat panel plasma and LCD screens.
2002.
Yes.
Wow. So that's old. So you're definitely close to ready to buy in a new television.
Well, the TV that I had before that was 16 years old. But yes, I guess I'm a little bit closer than most would be to buying a new television. And certainly the television industry or the TV electronics manufacturing industry is can't wait for me to buy a new TV because their sales are flat.
Well, yeah, and they should be. There was an article in the New York Times about how TV sales are flatlining a bit, and it makes perfect sense because over the past decade, they've had great success in getting people switching over to flat panel screens, to LCD and plasma screens. They had this sort of convergence of great opportunity. They had high-definition movies and TV shows becoming available. They had the switch over to digital.
Digital broadcasting, right.
Yeah, and they also had these new televisions that were thinner and lighter and smaller than the giant bulky screens before and had great, great picture. I mean, you could see the dramatic difference in picture quality, especially when you were watching high-definition programming, and you couldn't enjoy that high-def programming unless you got one of these new TVs. So everything conspired to create a perfect storm of desire for people to switch to nice, big, new LCD and plasma screens and watch their sports programming and ER and everything on these new televisions. And it worked. Everybody bought a new TV. I have one.
And I don't.
You don't. But now, of course, everybody has one. And now they're saying, well, come on, now we want you to buy a 3D television. Now we want you to buy this. Now we want you to buy that. And people are saying, dude, I've got a television. I'm not buying another one for, you know, another decade.
But that's kind of the problem with this type of technology is that because of Moore's Law and, well, Moore's Law has more to do with computing than with televisions. But really, the cycle of technology is getting faster and faster and faster exponentially. And so while a television used to last you 16 years, now 8 years, and I'm ready for a new one.
Yeah, or 8 or 10 years. But I mean, and they want us to be quicker. But no, my TV's gone. I don't feel like my TV is outdated. It's not like comparing a computer to a computer from 3 or 4 years ago where you say, oh my God, it's so pokey, it's so slow. My TV's great.
Well, that is the life cycle of a computer, about 4 years, and analysts and TV makers are now assuming that the lifespan of a television is 5 to 7 years.
Malarkey, malarkey. That's what they want. But people are not going to be replacing their TV every 5 years. That's crazy.
I would agree with that. And I think that really for 3D, there just isn't enough content, A. So that's the first problem, is there's not enough content. And then even if there is enough content, there's all of these hidden costs like glasses, and you have to have a special Blu-ray player if you want to play the content. And so it's not just the television. That's an issue.
Now, I know that John Reavy, in the article in the New York Times, he's the senior vice president for home entertainment at Samsung, said that 3D has actually launched really well and done a great job, that they've sold more than 1 million 3D TVs in 2010, which is better than LED and HD and Blu-ray did in their first year. But I think what he's talking about is 3D compatible TVs. I don't think that all those people ponied up and spent all the money to have the glasses and everything. Because, I mean, I don't know a single person who owns a 3D TV.
You're absolutely right. Now, almost every TV you buy is 3D compatible. So when he says, oh, almost a million were sold. Yeah, okay, so then you sold 1 million TVs last year. That's really what you're saying. I agree with you. I think that most people are just buying a future-proofed television rather than going with a cheaper model that might be HD, might be flat panel, but isn't 3D.
Yeah, I'm still not sold on 3D in the home. But I know that there's more options becoming available.
Well, certainly, yeah. There's a service called Vudu, which Walmart bought last year. It's a home movie video on demand streaming service. And they are planning to stream 3D content straight to consumers through their little Vudu box.
So it's like Netflix.
A little bit, but you have to have the special Vudu box. Because of CES last week, they announced this plan to stream 3D content into the home. And they have three Disney titles to start off with. They have Meet the Robinsons, Bolt, and Chicken Little.
Is that it?
That is it.
Oh, boy.
Well, I'm sure they'll get more, especially if they are the only service right now doing this. But I'm sure they won't be the last, and they're going to have more content.
So they're talking about 3D for 3D compatible TVs where you have their own special glasses.
Yes, 3D capable HD TVs and Blu-ray disc players, the PlayStation 3 and Boxy. Those are the devices that the movies can be streamed out on.
Whatever. So that's very, very niche. There's very few people that could even look at that even if they wanted to.
Well,
so
and I know I'm going to get dinged for saying that you need a Vudu box. You probably don't now. They probably have it just streaming direct to some of these capable devices.
It's like, well, big deal, but that's far less interesting than the Comcast news.
Yes, the Comcast news is kind of interesting, and I saw a demo of this product. It's an iPad app, because, you know, you're not anything unless you have an iPad app these days. And it's this Xfinity iPad app where they will deliver thousands of hours, really, of video on demand to this tablet device. And they're going to give users live TV programming on it as well. That's the big news, is that you will get live TV on your iPad through Comcast's Xfinity app.
Right. So basically, if you're a subscriber to a cable company, in this case, Comcast, the idea is that you can watch some television on your TV, but hey, why shouldn't you be able to watch it on your iPad or your iPhone or whatever mobile or tablet device you want? However, it's limited right now to in your home. So you have to be, I guess, sitting on the deck with your iPad or up in your bedroom and be able to look at it on those devices. You can't go out in the world, which is what you really want.
No, I didn't know that. I thought you could go out in the world, but you have to subscribe.
Nope. It's in your home.
Oh.
They're petrified about putting it out in the world.
Okay, well, I do know that it is an extension of Comcast TV Everywhere service, which is if you subscribe to HBO, then you can subscribe to HBO on your, you know, watch it on your computer. But you'll just get that for free. Same thing with the iPad app. Previously, the Comcast iPad app acted as a remote DVR control. So what you selected on the iPad app all of a sudden showed up on your TV, or it had the TV listings as well. But
right.
But this is a, you know, taking it to the next level.
Yeah, what I should talk about, they have video on demand, which you can do anywhere, literally, but the live streaming where you're watching your cable channel live can only be done when you're in your home.
Okay.
And that's so ridiculous because people have Slingbox and other things, so they can do that anywhere in the world right now, but they're petrified for some reason, and that's what they're doing.
So they're hampering themselves.
Exactly, which is so stupid.
So then really, this is not a big deal at all.
Nope, it's a big whoop.
Ah, so you must be talking about our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story of the week is literally hot off the presses. The Directors Guild of America has announced its nominees for Best Director, and because it's one of the best harbingers of the Oscars, these nominations really matter. And they are Darren Aronofsky for Black Swan, David Fincher for The Social Network, Tom Hooper for The King's Speech, Christopher Nolan for Inception, and David O. Russell for The Fighter. Aronofsky, Hooper, and Russell are all first-time nominees. Missing are the Coen brothers for True Grit, Lisa Kolednikow for The Kids Are All Right, and others. Michael, are the DGA nominees a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, they're a big deal. They absolutely mirror, note for note, the Golden Globe nominations for Best Director and for Best Drama. So these are clearly the five frontrunners for the Oscars. And I think it's Lisa Cholodenko is how you say her name. But one of them could easily fall out. There's always that sort of little, you know, fillip. But this is a big deal for these people. They are definitely the frontrunners for the Oscars.
The History Channel has decided the Kennedys are too hot to handle. The cable channel had commissioned the most expensive fictional series in its history, a mini-series look at the Kennedys created by Joel Surnow, the conservative man behind the hit series 24. Criticized for its fast and loose approach to history in an early draft, the work starring Greg Kinnear and Katie Holmes underwent many changes while filming, but having looked at the final product, not to mention being lobbied fiercely by the Kennedy clan, the History Channel has decided the miniseries doesn't meet their standards for historical accuracy and are walking away from the project. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, this is a big deal in a couple ways. First of all, the History Channel, like everybody, needs to keep coming up with original programming, and this was a huge statement by them to commission this miniseries and to abandon it and walk away from it at this stage weeks before it would air in the spring is very bad for them and bad for the creative community and any deals they may want to make with people in the future. But let's also remember the idea that this doesn't match their standards of historical accuracy. This is the channel that runs shows and specials like Ancient Aliens, Haunted History, The Nostradamus Effect, UFO Files, UFO Hunters, and endless stories about the 2012 Mayan calendar predicting the end of the world. So the idea that this miniseries doesn't meet their standards is laughable.
You know, I have found many factual errors in their UFO Files show.
You were not probed in that way?
I was not probed in that way, no, not at all. Is Babs about to make a dramatic comeback? Other than the Fockers comedies, Barbra Streisand has only made two films in the past 20 years, The Mirror Has Two Faces and The Prince of Tides. Both received Oscar nominations and both were directed by Streisand. Now she's circling around a feature film remake of Gypsy. Streisand met with the show's surviving creators, Stephen Sondheim and Arthur Lawrence. They loved the idea, and Lawrence suggested Tom Hanks for the key male role of Herbie. Now the only question is, who will direct? Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal. She makes far too few movies. She doesn't record enough or make enough acting performances. I'd love them to take Laura Benanti, who won a Tony for her performance as Mama Rose's daughter in the recent Broadway revival. But this is a perfect fit for her. This would be great. So I'm very excited. And she should direct. Why not?
And I saw the 2008 revival, which starred Patti LuPone.
It'll make its movies ripe for remake. The original version with Rosalind Russell was not great, so it'd be exciting to see what happens.
Yeah, I love the fact that Arthur Lawrence said, or is it Lorenz, said, I would be very pleased if we had a different film version of for the historical record.
And of course, there's a TV movie version with Bette Midler that also did very well in the ratings, but it's ripe for feature film remake.
Are you sick of hearing about Snooki and the situation? Well, too bad. The Jersey Shore continues to get bigger and bigger for MTV. The season 3 debut was MTV's highest rated series broadcast ever, hitting 8.4 million viewers. That's more than 60% jump over the season 2 debut of 5.1 million viewers. Now MTV has to fork over the dough for a season 4. Michael, is the fact that the Jersey Shore continues to grow a big deal or a big whoop?
Unfortunately, it's a big deal, and they need to lock these people up for more than one season at a time.
Ugh, I can't take them for more than 1 minute at a time. This item about Huckleberry Finn contains some inflammatory language, so if you have little kids listening, you might want to jump ahead to the next entry.
And there is a Santa Claus.
Yes, there is a Santa Claus, and if you don't know what we're talking about, go back a few episodes. Mark Twain's classics, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, have all but disappeared from middle and high school reading lists around the country because of their use of the N-word. Now a Twain scholar and a small press are coming out with a single-volume edition that contains both books and replaces the word nigger with slave. So, for example, Jim is referred to as the Slave Jim rather than the Nigger Jim. They've also eliminated the word engine, as in Injun Joe. This has sparked a storm of controversy and comment. Michael, is this whitewashing of Twain a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, you know, I think it's a big deal and ridiculous. Kids hear the N-word, nigger, constantly in rap and hip-hop music. The book should be taught. Huckleberry Finn is not even a kid's book, frankly. It is for high school and college level. It's an incredibly serious book, but it's all about racism. And if you can't talk about the book and can't deal with what's in the book, it just makes no sense. If you were going to write a book today about life back in the mid-1800s and having white people referring to black people and slaves, you would use the word nigger. It's like, it's not like it's an archaic phrase that, you know, was used haphazardly. It belongs in the book. The book is a masterpiece, and it's just insane that they would do this. But that's what happens when books go into the public domain.
Well, you know, film critic Roger Ebert agrees with you. He was very upset over the news that Huck Finn was being censored. He tweeted, "I'd rather be called a nigger than a slave." That's what he tweeted, and that caused a bit of an uproar, and by the next day he tweeted, "You know, this is very true. I'll never be called a nigger or a slave, so I should have shut the asterisk, 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 asterisk up."
Yeah, my favorite tweet was a guy who said now that they've censored a Huckleberry Finn, he can't wait to start reading the classic novel Moby Richard. Rather than Moby Dick. But it's insane that schools aren't teaching it, and it's a shame if they're having trouble and parents keep complaining out of idiotic sense of propriety, but the solution is not to teach this expurgated version.
There's no doubting that MySpace is clearly on the ropes. News Corp has confirmed that MySpace is laying off half the staff in the next week or so, and selling the website by mid-year. They haven't really confirmed that they're selling the website, but they're in talks. Michael, are the travails of MySpace a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It shows how hard you can fall. They try to revamp. It's not working. And everyone thinks Facebook is inviolable and is strong and be there for 100 years. And I'm not convinced. I think they could be vulnerable too. You never know what'll happen. People who seem that they're completely number one and will always be number one can fall quick and hard.
Hold on, I'm just updating my status message with what you said there. Filmmaker Ed Burns thinks the Comcast-NBCU merger is hunky-dory. Burns had a self-financed film, Nice Guy Johnny, and he says his experience in getting the virtually straight-to-DVD movie placed on Comcast's on-demand lineup was very positive, and that the merger would be good for indie filmmakers. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Ed Burns is not a very good analyst. So yeah. Why he felt the need to give his opinion on this merger is a shocker. The idea that it would be good for indie filmmakers makes no sense.
Quentin Tarantino oversaw the jury that gave Sofia Coppola's Somewhere the top prize at this past year's Venice Film Festival. So why wasn't Somewhere anywhere to be seen on his list of top films from 2010? Abashed and embarrassed, Tarantino says there's no conspiracy or attempt to slur Coppola's film. He says he kept all the films he viewed at Venice off his list because he felt like he'd already spoken out on them. People knew he really liked Somewhere, and his top 20 list was meant to highlight other films. Films like Robin Hood, Night and Day, and Jackass 3D. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, and I like his explanation, but this does mean that he creates his best movies of the year list different than anyone else who's ever existed before in history. It's like, oh, well, I already gave that award, so I won't want to mention it again. It's like, no. Whether you vote for it at the Oscars or not shouldn't change the fact that it's, you know, one of your favorite films of the year.
Yeah, I think that will be the first and last top 20 list we ever see out of Mr. Tarantino.
It wasn't the first. He does it every year.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
As our friend and former co-host Karen Woodward always says, celebrities should not be tweeting willy-nilly. Rocker Courtney Love might agree. She's now being sued for tweets she sent out about fashion designer Dawn... Oh, I can't pronounce that last name.
Semarangir.
Okay, what he said. Now, Love accused her, this fashion designer, of being a drug-pushing prostitute with a history of assault and battery. Now, Love is embroiled in what appears to be the first defamation trial over a celebrity's tweets. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a footnote in history, but it's a big deal legally, and people got to realize, saying it on Twitter or putting it on your Facebook page, baby, it's just like saying it any other way. You know, you can't just say what you want there.
F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby is considered one of the great novels of all time. It has glamour and despair, high society and criminal lowlifes, love and adultery. But you know what it's missing? 3D. That's what director Baz Luhrmann thinks. He's been workshopping a new film version of The Great Gatsby and is considering shooting the whole thing in 3D. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Oh, big whoop. I'm not even a big fan of the book.
Wow. Baz Luhrmann once had an opera on Broadway, so he will be glad to hear it was another record-setting year for The Great White Way, thanks to exorbitant ticket prices and hit shows like Wicked, The Lion King, Jersey Boys, Mamma Mia, The Addams Family, and Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. Broadway grossed just over $1 billion, $1.037 billion, more than the $1.004 billion they earned in 2009. About 12.11 million people saw a Broadway show last year, up from 11.95 million people in 2009. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's always good when you increase attendance and grosses, though I do think the high ticket prices are a problem long term. The good news is that it involves some hits like The Addams Family and Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. Unfortunately, Addams Family will probably collapse once Nathan Lane leaves the show, and Spider-Man is still a big question mark. So you always want new hits, and this year hasn't really produced any necessarily that'll last long term.
Ennio Morricone, the legendary Italian composer who has written scores for hundreds of films, including Cinema Paradiso, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, as well as The Untouchables, has signed a deal with LG to not only write brand new music for ringtones on their upcoming smartphones, but allow those phones to exclusively play some of his most famous themes. Morricone will write 15 brand new pieces of music for the phones and then allow 10 of his most famous pieces to be downloaded, in addition to an exclusive app that will have videos and more. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It'd be fun to see if, like, John Williams of Raiders of the Lost Ark and Jaws, whether he could get the same
and
sort
Star
of deal.
Star Wars and Close Encounters. And
yeah, and a million other movies. It's fascinating that a composer of his stature is creating original music for a phone, but that's the world we live in.
Well, Ennio Morricone is composing digital ringtones for LG, which brings us to Inside Baseball, where we will be joined by Ben Fritz from the Los Angeles Times, who wrote, it seems like at least three or four of the stories we talked about already today, but he wrote two specifically that we wanted to point out. One was on Fox putting their award screeners on iTunes for members of the Screen Actors Guild, and the other was about a new technology that's been developed by six studios who are looking to broaden the way they sell films and TV shows online. Ben, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Now, I guess we can take the first story here about Fox. What is Fox doing with iTunes?
So
So Fox Searchlight, their indie division, specialty division, is they want to get screeners in front of all the voters for the Screen Actors Guild Awards, but there are about 100,000 people in SAG, and that's a lot of screeners, and if you want to watermark them for security, that's just the logistical and financial impossibility. It's millions of dollars, and they couldn't do it. So most studios don't send screeners to SAG as a result, but Fox decided the way to do it is they would essentially put their three nominated movies, which are 127 Hours and Conviction and...
Black Swan.
Black Swan, thank you. On iTunes and give all the SAG members essentially a coupon for a free rental. And the rest of us can't rent it. It's kind of hidden. But if you're in SAG, you get the code, you can rent it in the same way you rent any other movie from iTunes and download it. You can have 24 hours to watch it. You can do it on your TV if you have Apple TV. You can do it on a computer, on your iPod, iPad, iPhone, etc. So it's kind of a clever way to get screeners out to a much larger audience and a much lower cost. And, you know, it could portend a future where we see a lot more screeners go out through the web rather than on DVDs.
Now, Ben, there's no question in your mind that this is the wave of the future, that in 10 years, Oscar voters will maybe be getting most of their screeners this way. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly in the guild and everything, I think for a while, Oscar voters will always have the option of DVD because a lot of Academy voters are older and maybe not the most tech savvy. And obviously, they're the most important awards. So if they want a DVD, they'll probably be able to get one. But for the other groups, especially the guilds that have thousands or tens of thousands of members, this will become sort of the only way it's done. And I think even for the Academy, it's going to become an option very soon because they can get them a screener sooner in the process and cheaper, and it's easier to take portable. It's kind of a no-brainer.
Well, now let's talk about that for a second. Fox is already talking to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and of course, they put on the Oscars. They're also talking to the British Film Academy, which puts on the BAFTAs. But a lot of people, some of the pushback on this is, gee, all of these people, they make these movies to be seen on a big screen with 5.1 surround sound and all of the technology and the craft that goes into it. Now you're putting it on an iPod.
Yeah, certainly that's a concern. I mean, I think Fox would be the first to tell you they would much prefer people see it in the theater. That's always the case. But they send out screeners because they know not everybody's going to. That's why all the studios do it. You know, and certainly if you watch it on a TV or a big computer monitor, an iTunes download is actually as good, if not higher quality, in fact, than a standard DVD. But you could certainly argue, and some cinematographers did to a couple of my colleagues who are a follow-up story, that they don't want their movies being seen on, a 3-inch iPhone or iPod, or even a 10-inch or 8-inch, whatever it is, iPad. So yeah, I could see some people, there's certainly some concern in Hollywood about that, yeah.
Yeah, because 127 Hours has a lot of quick cuts and flashy montages and visual flair. A movie like The King's Speech might play very well on your laptop, but a movie like 127 Hours obviously would play much better even on your large screen TV, as compared to a portable device.
Absolutely. Well, I would say, if other studios got in the game, it's hard to imagine watching Inception on a tiny 3 or 5-inch screen. I can't imagine that working. But on the other hand, if the option is see it that way or don't see it at all, it seems like you'd still want the voters to see it.
Yes, well, and as you mentioned, it would save the studio millions of dollars in actually manufacturing those award screeners and then distributing them. Certainly for the Academy, it's 6,000 members, but for the Screen Actors Guild, as you pointed out, it's 100,000 people. There's no way they could ever do that. Now, another area where studios are making some inroads with online video is with this ultraviolet technology, which was unveiled last week at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas after 4 years of development. What is this technology?
Ultraviolet, it was created by a consortium of all the major studios except Disney and a lot of major tech companies and retailers like Best Buy, Sony, Toshiba, LG, etc. And the idea is they really want digital distribution movies to become a vibrant business, which it's not yet. And most people don't download movies, buy them through the internet, because there's such restrictions on them. Studios are concerned about piracy, which we all understand, but you download it on one device and you can't transfer it to another. And whereas if you buy a DVD, it'll play on, there's 100 million DVD players out there in America, and you can watch it in your minivan, or you're watching in your living room, you can put it in your computer, you can loan it to your friend. So it's a very portable thing that we're used to. So, if you're going to download something for the same price, you expect it to be at least as portable and useful, if not more so. So Ultraviolet is sort of, all the companies involved have agreed on a technological standard and an anti-piracy standard, so that if you or to buy one of their movies that is through the Ultraviolet system, and it doesn't matter who you buy it from, as long as it's a part of Ultraviolet, then you have the rights to that movie, and it sits in the cloud. And so you can download it once on your computer and then download it again on a video game console somewhere else. And if the devices are Ultraviolet certified, you could transfer it from a phone to a computer to a tablet, et cetera. So and once you buy it, you own it. You can stream it again and again. You can download it again and again. You don't just own the copy. You actually own the rights to it, to watch it an unlimited number of times for well into the future.
Now, as a consumer, am I going to have to worry about this Ultraviolet technology? Am I going to have to be aware of it and know that one particular product or device is Ultraviolet compatible, but my iPod is not?
Yes, unfortunately, you are. Obviously, the ideal is most things are compatible, but certainly, the major problem is that Apple is not part of it yet, so it's not going to work with any iPod, iPad, iPhone, Apple TV, et cetera.
Oopsie.
And then you're gonna, yeah. So yeah, that's a major problem, but Apple doesn't like to, both Apple and Disney, which share Mr. Steve Jobs in common, they don't like to play with others very much. They tend to build their own proprietary stuff.
Right. And Disney built this kind of competing technology called KeyChest. What is that all about? Is it the same?
This is the same basic concept, which is that you buy it and you have the rights to it in the cloud, and you can transfer it between devices and stream it again and again and download it again and again, as long as you have a login and password.
But now, if only one studio is participating in that, does it have a future?
And it's hard to imagine. You would think one that has six studios, actually seven counting Lionsgate, versus one that has one studio, it seems like the one studio is going to have to give up and join. But we'll see whether Disney does that. If Ultraviolet is at least somewhat successful, the pressure will really be on Disney.
Well, Ben, here's my big question, and it's raised because of Amazon's Kindle. When I buy a movie via this way and it stays in the cloud, do I own the movie, or do I simply license the right to download it until they decide to take it away from me again?
Yes. Well, technically it's a license, right? But the only person who owns the movie is the studio. But it's a much, much more generous license than what you get when you download a movie today, or even when you buy a DVD. Because right now, if you buy a DVD and then we all upgrade to Blu-ray, well, you got to buy that Blu-ray again, right? But theoretically, through Ultraviolet, as long as you have a device that connects to the internet, you own the rights to that movie forever. You can always stream it again. You can always re-download it. So that's a big change. And it's the studios, on the one hand, it's opening themselves up. And you could argue, well, they're missing the opportunity to sell the same movie to you five times. But what they see the reality of the situation, which is that if they don't make digital downloads more useful, nobody's going to pay to buy movies anymore in the digital future. They're either going to just stream it through Netflix or rent it through iTunes, or they're going to pirate it.
Well, now, video sales have fallen again this past year.
Yeah.
I guess sales were down, I guess it depends on who you ask. In 2009, the decline was 7.6%, and I guess sales were down 3% over the past year to $18.8 billion in 2010.
Yeah.
So will this help? Will a technology like Ultraviolet help boost those sales?
That's the hope, because right now digital is still only about 4% of the market. And even within that, most people who get movies online rent them. They don't buy them. The studios really want you to buy movies because a purchase is so much more profitable for them than a rental. And and the purchase and sale of DVDs in the past decade has been the main profit driver for the entertainment industry. And if we move to a digital future where everybody rents and nobody buys, then that's going to really impact the economics of Hollywood. So this is meant to not only boost that overall total that you said, but within it to boost purchases over rentals in the internet age.
Well, certainly we appreciate you being here with us this week. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us, not only about Ultraviolet and what the studios are doing to broaden their online sales, but also about Fox's plans to put award screeners on iTunes, at least for members of the Screen Actors Guild. Now, your writing can be found at the Los Angeles Times, and of course, you're on Twitter. Your username is Ben Fritz, BenFritz.
Yes, it is. And thank you again for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Well, that was interesting. It's nice to know that studios are thinking about not trying to screw you over in every new format change just to soak you for, to buy a movie over and over again. I've bought certain albums and certain movies three or four or five times. And if we go digital and they're willing to keep upgrading you, maybe that's a silver lining to this.
They have certainly managed to get consumers to purchase first VHS tapes, then DVDs, now Blu-rays, and now, of course, the digital versions. There's no need, necessarily, at least for the foreseeable future, to make you purchase it again. Unless I guess they come up with, I don't know, 4K or, you know, super HD or super, super HD. And then, you know, you'll have to kind of upgrade.
It's 3D holograms where you step into the film and take one of the roles.
Well, I don't know if home video technology is going to allow you to put yourself in a movie anytime soon. But I do know you could put yourself into our podcast, Showbiz Sandbox, every single week. And that's exactly what Andrew Einsbrook did when he emailed us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. And he's from Wild Pure Heart Productions in Braidwood, Australia. And Michael, why don't you read what he had to say?
Okay, Andrew wrote, "Hi guys, I'm a longtime listener and very much enjoy your insights and news. May I suggest that now that Karen is not a regular, you might consider taking this opportunity to stop verbally flagging your segues. You would not care for it if a movie said, 'Here's a cross dissolve,' or 'That's our fade in, fade out.' So too, I would suggest that segues are best when they are smooth and transparent. Just my two bits, and thanks for thinking about it. Love the show, guys, and keep up the good work. Cheers, Andrew. Andrew Einsbrook of Wild Pure Heart Productions in Braidwood, Australia. And let me take this opportunity to apologize to everyone in Australia. We got another email from Australia. Or was it New Zealand? I forget. But a woman wrote to us about the show, and I read her email in a ridiculous Australian accent. I thought Karen and Sperling would stop me and chide me for it. But in fact, not only did they not stop me, they didn't laugh or say a single word, and it went past unnoticed. And so for that accent, which probably sounded like about as authentic as Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins, I do apologize. Well, I couldn't believe you guys didn't stop me and say, "What are you doing?" And then I was too embarrassed to say anything once it was all over.
Well, I didn't. That was on a past episode, and yeah. I didn't want to interrupt you. And I think Karen felt the same way. And we should say, if you want to look up Andrew's work, you can do so. WildPureHeart.com is the email address, and he is on Twitter. WildPureHeart is the Twitter handle to look up. And Andrew, I have to say, one of the things that Michael and I have been discussing, and when Karen was here, we discussed it as well, is how do we segue? Do we stop in between, say, television and music, or music and movies, and, you know, say, we'll be back with movie news, or, you know, now on to music news? Do we place music in between each segment? We've certainly been getting a lot of advice from listeners, and I speak for myself. I appreciate all of the input. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, it became a running gag, and now we'll probably let that gag rest.
Yes. And if you do want to let us know what you think, you can, again, email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address, or you can leave us a voicemail, and please make them a short voicemail. We keep getting like 3-minute voicemails, and the show's only an hour, people. Can't play the whole voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, if you want to find out when Michael did that Australian accent, you can go to our website, showbizsandbox.com, where you can not only find links to all of the stories we've discussed in today's podcast, but all of our past episodes as well. And you can look for the one that Michael did his accent. He does a lot of accents in numerous episodes. So I say download them all and get back to us with which ones he does the accent in. Now, you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. You can even subscribe to us on Twitter, or you can join us on Facebook. All those links, again, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael can be found at michaelgiltz.com or on Twitter at michaelgiltz is his username. My username on Twitter is Sperling. And you can find some of my writing at Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.